called, he said, reading the leaflet. They're very popular. They have all these magic tricks you can do. He turned to Paige. And demonstrations. Ways to get out spots and stains, ink, grease, blood. You actually do it right in front of them. See? He said, holding it out to her.
I couldn't do that, she said weakly.
Of course you can, he crooned as he patted her arm. You can do anything you set your mind to, Marie Vermeule.
No, I couldn't do that, she said again.
She got up from the table then and stood in front of the window. The moonlight lay in narrow strips across the Klubach's lawn. Jesse Klubach had a husband who worked and a life that worked, always baking cookies, planting bulbs in October before the ground froze, at Christmas sending over her own fruitcake soaked in rum, all done up in a red tin, then standing out there with the neighbors singing carols into the cold, lonely night, the worst night of the year, rubbing it in, trapping them all inside here, as she hissed at her children not to go near the windows, they'll see us. All they want is to sing us Christmas carols. No, what they want is to get in here and have a good look around. Not a neighbor on this street had ever stepped foot inside this house in her 10 years here, and now all of a sudden she was going to invite them in to witness the holes in the walls, the threadbare couch shored up with a can, the chipped red plaster lamp she and Norm had won at bingo at the fair years ago, while she performed magic tricks? What? Juggling detergent bottles? My God, what had she been thinking of? What kind of mess had she gotten herself into here? For all his assurances, he did not know her at all, did he? All his promises, and what had he actually done? He had taken her money, that's what he'd done.
I'll help you, he said. There's more than one way to do this, you know.
She turned. She was very tired. She could see how much they needed her, him perhaps even more than her children. She was tired of being needed. She was so very, very tired. All this, she thought, biting her lip. All this because, a long time ago, she had made a fatal mistake. She had fallen in love too young with the wrong man. Imagine. It was as simple as that, and now she would never catch up. She would never be happy.
Come on,
Omar said, pulling out a chair.
Sit down and let me tell you another way to do it.
She looked at him. Because she couldn't speak, she just kept shaking her head. Mom? Mom? Her sons, her two boys, were calling someone who was very, very tired.
Marie?
She's not interested, Norm said. She's not gonna sell soap. She's not gonna have stupid parties, so just get your crap out of here.
He was sweeping the pamphlets back into the bags. Benji glanced back and forth between Omar and his brother.
Here, Norm cried, thrusting the bag at Omar's chest. Take it and get the hell out of here.
Fascinated, she watched her male image mirrored in her son's rage, the strong twin soul whose freer heart, willful and blunt, needed no man's approval or permission.
Watch your mouth, boy,
Omar warned, his sweat-slicked face at Norm's.
You hear me?
Norm shoved Omar away from him.
Go ahead. Do something about it, he snarled,
yet almost seemed to smile, to take pleasure in this.
Come on.
Norm! Benji yelled as he grabbed his brother's arm. He kept trying to pull him back.
Stop it! Don't do that! He begged. Don't! Please, Norm, please don't!
Her younger son's terror struck her from this daze.
Norm!
They looked, waiting for the rest of it.
Please don't,
she finally said. Norm stayed between her and Duval, so that however she turned or stepped away, he moved with her, swaying, it almost seemed, his desperate fluidity demanding all of her attention.
Mom, listen, please, just listen.
She worked hard enough. They'd always managed before. They didn't need Duval or any of his wacky schemes. There were jobs he could get after school. Benji could get a paper route. One thing was for sure, she would never peddle soap door to door or do any goddamn magic tricks. No, absolutely not. But I have to, she said, with an eerie calm that coated every sharp edge and glaring plane with its dull veneer. I've already paid for it, and I can't get my money back. Benji hunched low in the seat. They were speeding down the narrow road from the house in the flats where Norm had just bought 4 bottles of beer from the fabled Mrs. Carper, who turned out to be just a skinny lady in pin curls and red slipper socks. Norm guzzled the first bottle as he drove, then belched loudly. He slowed down as they approached a small country cemetery, its dozen or so ancient gravestones huddled around a tall blackened stone cross that probably bore the family name. This Benji knew from rides with their mother when they'd been younger. They didn't go anywhere together anymore. He wondered if they would be buried together in a family plot some day. His eyes widened with the thought of the dead man, early, exposed and completely alone now that the dog no longer came to roll against its foulness. Norm held the bottle by its neck, then hurled it through the window. It shattered on one of the markers. Norm's laugh chilled him.
"You shouldn't have done that," he said,
goosebumps mottling his arms.
"Oh, yeah?"
Norm said, glancing over.
"Well, let me tell you something you shouldn't have done. You shouldn't have stuck up for that asshole Duval."
"I wasn't sticking up for him. I just didn't want Mom all upset."
What he wanted to say was that he had been sticking up for Norm.
"You know, you've got this thing, this weird idea that Duval's some knight in shining armor or something. I don't think you know what's going on."
Norm had opened the second bottle, which he kept between his legs now as they came through town. Benji was afraid Norm was getting drunk. They stopped at a red light on Merchant's Row, and Norm finished the bottle. As they drove around, Norm kept looking for Weeb, who had found himself a girlfriend during Norm's house arrest. "The beastly Donna Kreller," Norm howled. Jesus Christ, how could he sink so low? Benji didn't say anything about the time he'd seen Donna Kreller with Norm in this very car. They cruised up and down Merchant's Row, deserted except for a few wandering dogs. Parked in front of the empty bus depot was a police car. Inside, Victor the cop was licking an ice cream cone. He scowled as they went by, and Norm groaned.
"Tough duty," Norm pretended to yell. "Hey, creep, you got nothing to do? Go pick up Omar Duval before there's a murder."
"What do you mean murder?" Benji asked.
"Just what I said. That fucking Duval would just as soon kill me as look at me."
He glanced at Benji.
"Can't you tell? He wouldn't think twice about it."
Benji held his breath with the vivid image of the two hands grappling for the glinting blade. Now they were on a road Benji did not recognize. They flew past still fields of young corn and hilly pastures, then dark stretches of woods. He begged Norm to slow down. The road was too winding. The car skidded around a curve. Now he was as mad as he was scared. Norm didn't care what happened to either of them. He opened another bottle, and Benji pleaded with him not to drink any more. He'd get in trouble again like that night at the lake, only this time would be even worse because he was driving.
"I got you home safe and sound, didn't I?"
Norm said with a bitter laugh as he turned off the headlights.
"See, I can even do it in the dark."
Branches slapped against the side of the car, and the tires crunched over gravel. "No," Benji was screaming now as he told Norm that Mrs. Haddad had driven them home from the lake that night.
"What?"
Norm squealed.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"It was Mrs. Haddad who had driven them home," he yelled, with the night rushing through the open windows. "Mrs. Haddad who had pulled into the wrong driveway."
"You're full of shit."
"It's true,"
Benji gasped.
"And then she left, and you were so drunk you couldn't wake up, and I kept trying to wake you up to move the car, but you wouldn't, Norm. You were too drunk."
Norm turned on the headlights, but they continued to race along.
"So who moved the car?"
Benji didn't answer. Norm jammed on the brakes, and they skidded to a stop. He grabbed Benji's arms.
"It was that fucking Duval, wasn't it? He moved the car. He killed Klubach's fucking dog, and then he set me up, didn't he?"
Norm was shaking him.
"And you let him, you little creep! How could you do that?"
Norm was hitting him now with the back of his hand on the side of his head, his shoulders, his chest.
"What's wrong with you? Don't you have any balls? Doesn't anything matter to you?"
Norm's voice pitched higher, then broke.
"I'm your fucking brother, for Christ's sake!"
Benji was sobbing.
"It was me, Norm. I'm the one that moved the car. I'm the one that killed Klubach's fucking dog."
"Jesus Christ!"
Norm roared, staring at him, his raised fists trembling.
"And you let me take all that shit, you little bastard! I'm gonna kill you! I'm gonna..." "Ah, shit! Don't cry, please, Benji."
"I'm so sorry, Norm," he sobbed. "I was just trying to move the car so you wouldn't get in trouble."
"Oh, Benj. Ah, shit. I mean, you really liked that fucking dog, didn't you?"
Benji nodded, and he realized that Norm was crying, too. A few minutes later, when they were driving back into town, Norm wondered aloud why Mrs. Haddad had never said anything to their mother about that night. She was drunk, too, Benji explained.
But how come you didn't tell her it was the wrong driveway?
I was down in back. I didn't want her to see me.
He tried to clear his throat. Norm looked at him.
Why? What else happened that night?
He shrugged. She tried to go parking with you.
What do you mean, tried?
Benji related the little he'd seen and all that he'd heard.
Are you serious?
Norm cried as they drove by the park, where Joey Selden sat on his stool in the corner of his stand.
Hey, Joey!
Norm cried out the window, honking the horn joyously.
Mrs. Haddad put the make on me, can you believe it?
Joey raised both hands, waving the way he did whenever any of the kids called out to him. The horn stuck and kept blaring up the street, but Norm didn't seem to care. Though he wasn't sure exactly how or what it was, Benji could see that he had just given his brother something wonderful. In the next few days, a carpet of soggy heat rolled over Atkinson. The trees were dismal in the stillness, their meager shade teeming with mosquitoes. Children stayed indoors. Women dreaded entering their kitchens, where everything seemed to turn rancid and greasy. Ponds and lakes seethed with swimmers and boats, and at night the only breezes came through the open windows of cruising cars. An 83-year-old record had been broken. The heat was the topic of every conversation, even eclipsing Atkinson's crime wave. Though only Celeste's beauty parlor and Spectre's hardware had reported any money missing, 5 downtown stores had been broken into, and yet the Atkinson Crier ran a front-page picture of Renee LeChance smiling proudly in front of his window fan display. "Fan Man," said the picture caption, calling Renee LeChance the valley's largest supplier of fans. The reporter had asked Renee why he had ordered 75 fans instead of his usual 15 or 20.
"I don't know. I just did," he had answered, with a small, dull ache like a hole forming in his chest. "What was it?"
the reporter persisted, pen poised.
"Some kind of intuition, maybe? Like a sixth sense? You know, like some animals have before storms and things?"
"I don't know,"
Renee said shyly, as the photographer pivoted to shoot from another angle.
"More like wishful thinking, maybe."
The reporter asked what he meant. Renee thought a minute.
"Well, some things you want so bad you just forget everything else that's going on and even good common sense. And then the next thing I know, just like that, suddenly I got 75 fans being delivered."
The reporter wrote down every word. She asked more questions. At first, Renee's answers were tentative and awkward-sounding, but then, the more he talked, the better he seemed to get at it. Soon, the reporter had him reminiscing about his early years in Canada. It was all printed in the paper, right there on the front page, along with his tips on how people could create their own air conditioning by placing a wash tub of ice in front of a window fan. He recommended wearing white garments, drinking tepid beverages, as well as deep breathing through the nose, since mouth breathing built up gassy poisons in the belly. In that next week, he sold 37 fans. Everywhere he went, people said hello. And best of all, the Golden Toasty salesman was coming Friday to see if his business merited his being an exclusive Golden Toasty retailer. When the salesman arrived, there were 4 customers shopping for fans. Renee got Hannaby's shoeshine boy to mind the place while he took the dapper young salesman to lunch at the luncheonette. Renee was proud to be seen with him. People smiled at Renee, and a few even called him by name. He felt like a successful man in the community, vital and respected. So exhilarated was he that when Eunice came to take their order, he knew what he wanted, but couldn't remember the name.
"It's 2 pieces of toast, and inside there's cheese, melted cheese."
He spoke loudly with exaggerated gestures as if she were deaf.
"Sounds like grilled cheese to me," she called back just as loudly.
"Yeah, that's right," Renee cried.
"Jackpot,"
she winked at the salesman.
"Your turn now. I'm going to concentrate real hard. Hope I get it."
Renee slapped the table as he gasped with laughter. What a sense of humor. That Eunice, she was one funny lady. That's why he liked her calls the best.
"Tuna on rye with tomato sliced thin," said the salesman,
his quiet dignity a dash of icy water on Renee's mirth. Renee folded his hands on the table. Golden Toasty was serious business. They wanted to be represented by a serious man.
"I usually don't take lunchtime,"
he said, explaining the importance of keeping regular hours.
Customers rely on that. Good business means happy customers. Happy customers mean good business.
He'd memorized that this morning off a golden toasty pamphlet. The salesman said he was impressed by the way Reeny handled his customers, but he had to keep in mind that Golden Toasty's first requirement was a premier location.
Which I got, acknowledged Reeny with a confident nod.
The salesman looked puzzled.
But you're on a back street.
I know. Right across from the parking lot to Cushing's and the back door.
Cushing's?
It's the second largest department store in the state, he boasted,
a bit deflated until the salesman said that this was new territory for him. To fill him in, Reeny explained that on the average day, 121 people went through those doors.
I know. I've been keeping count every day for years.
You have? Why?
The salesman was obviously impressed.
I just like to,
he said, with a modest shrug under the young man's constant gaze. The salesman cleared his throat.
Do they sell toasters?
No,
he whispered, leaning forward.
You see, that's just it. They got a household department, towels and dishes and stuff, but no small appliances, if you can believe it. That's why I know this is going to be a big hit.
You know, an intrinsic component of a premier location is the store's appearance, how it looks inside,
the salesman said with the last bite of his sandwich. Reeny hadn't even started on his.
Yeah, that's a good idea,
Reeny said, waving Eunice over to the booth. He tried to order another sandwich for the salesman, who kept insisting he was full.
Then just take it for later when you get hungry,
Reeny persisted, while Eunice sighed and tapped her pen on the order pad. Apologizing for his indecision, the salesman said he'd love some deep-dish apple pie a la mode and coffee. Smooth, Reeny thought. A really smooth guy. He took out his wallet and from a photo slot removed the soiled paint chip. Just holding it gave him a good feeling.
I'm having the whole inside painted, and this here's the color. Buttercup yellow.
He squinted, pretending to read the back of the paint chip, though he knew it by heart, for he had shown it to so many customers. He held it out to the salesman.
I'm doing everything the same. Ceiling, the walls, and maybe, I've been thinking, even the floor.
He stared at the salesman, hoping he got the connection. Golden toasty, golden atmosphere. The salesman kept looking at the paint chip.
How many toaster names do you carry now?
4, Reeny said. But to tell you the truth, I'd drop 'em all just to get the golden toasty.
Damn, he could never say that word right. When the salesman had eaten his pie, he seemed eager to leave. He explained that he had to submit the location survey along with his recommendation to his supervisor. That process alone could take a few weeks. Reeny smiled. He'd know in just a few weeks whether or not he'd been approved. The salesman had left his car parked in front of the store. He walked so quickly Reeny had a hard time keeping up. As they hurried along through the sharp heat, Reeny was dizzied by the contrast of the sun-bleached sidewalks and glaring storefronts, and then the deep black shade of the alleys. He couldn't help noticing that he and the young man were the same height. The salesman's brown hair was as dark and thick as Reeny's had once been. He asked him his age. 28, the salesman said, and for a moment Reeny couldn't tell if he was still breathing. Though he had stopped walking, the black and white images continued to flash in his brain. He asked the salesman his birthday. August 21, he answered.
Maybe she made a mistake,
Reeny thought.
Or maybe the baby came early.
He asked where he'd been born, and the salesman said that, to be honest, he wasn't really sure because he'd been adopted. But he'd been raised in Tarrytown, New York. Reeny begged the young man to come into the store. He paid the shoeshine boy, and as soon as he left, he hung the closed sign on the door. The salesman fidgeted with his car keys as Reeny pulled out his slender green ledgers and opened them on the counter. In here, he explained, were all his most important thoughts. He had to be careful, didn't want to shock the young man. And, of course, he might be wrong. But what if he was right? What if this was that moment he'd been dreaming of and dreading all these years? The young man shuffled his feet. Reeny tried to ease into it. This was the ledger that contained the daily count of all the people entering Cushing's by that back door over there. The salesman looked out at Cushing's lot. Reeny found just the page he wanted and began to read.
April 3. 49 degrees. Sunny, no wind. Business medium. Noon count,
29 people use back door of Cushing's. Here it was. Very nice family here. Mother, father, and son. They love each other. Father kept tying son's shoes. Every time father starts looking at stoves again, the boy unties his shoes. Finally, father says, "How come it's unlaced again?" And the boy says, "I don't know." Father says, "I know, you keep doing it." He hugs the boy, and they all three laugh. I was happy and I was sad. All day I keep thinking that could be me and him, if only I'd have done the right thing. He closed his eyes and for a moment could not open them.
"Mr. LeChance," the salesman said, "I don't mean to seem rude, but I have more calls to make."
"Oh, sure, sure," Reaney said, running his finger down the page as if trying to find something. "I just want to get to the next part, that 31 people used Cushing's back door in the afternoon." He cleared his throat and tried to smile.
"Well, that's certainly good to know," the salesman said, extending his hand to shake Reaney's.
The long, thin fingers made Reaney's heart swell with pride. He watched him drive away. A few minutes later, he saw the salesman drive into Cushing's lot, then push open the gold-banded doors into the store. Reaney smiled. Of course he'd want to verify Reaney's data. Of course, any son of his would be one shrewd cookie.
Dr. Litchfield had sent Helen LeChance a treatment summary of her brother's confinement. The letter ended with the strong suggestion that Mr. Fermoyle seek more traditional therapy than that available to him at Applegate. Stapled to the letter was the final bill, $529, $490 for the last week's regular rate, and the extra $39 for monies a certain Miss Getchell claimed that Sam had borrowed from her the night of his escape. Helen sent a money order off the next day. She said little to Sam, tolerating his presence in her home, in her life, as another of the inevitable conundrums with which God had burdened her. Two of her apartments were empty. The apartments, she corrected herself, bile seeping into her throat as she thought of Josie Amenka, who was threatening to quit if Sam said one more word to her. Besides, she'd whispered shyly to Helen, she and Grandine Carson were thinking of getting married. He wanted to sell his garbage truck and the pig farm and move into a retirement trailer park in Florida. And after 30 years with the Fermoyles, she needed a change, according to Carson, who had hiked his collection fee 25 cents a barrel, knowing full well there wasn't a thing Helen could say or do about it. And now, on top of everything else, there was Reaney suddenly, in this heat, an authority in all matters, expounding on the weather, religion, politics, the way his wife treated him, particularly the way his wife treated him. He was threatening to move back into her bedroom. Let her try hanging her clothes in the pantry closet and see how she liked smelling all the time of vinegar and fish. Last night he had burst into the house weeping and carrying on like a crazy man about the son he claimed he had seated in the belly of a whore in New York City almost 30 years ago. He had thrown himself across her body and tried to pry her legs apart. For once in his life, he moaned, he was going to act like a man. Something had snapped inside to make her laugh. And that was when he circled his thick hands around her neck, whispering that it was the only decent thing about her, this fine, long neck he had admired when he first saw her years ago. She sighed now, her fingers pausing on the cold black beads of her rosary. Across the room, Sam's head hung over the columns of figures he'd been adding and subtracting for the past hour. She tried not to smile. Her mind, ever the swifter calculator, clicked over a longer column of figures, sums that bridged years and far outspanned his meager accounting of how every cent of their mother's $10,000 trust had been spent. She knew, remembered every penny, every nickel and dime he'd ever begged, lied for, or pilfered from her. He raked his fingers through his thinning hair, he bit his lip, scribbled out one whole row, began again. The last bead slid between her thumb and forefinger.
"As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. World without end. Amen."
She laid the rosary tenderly in its silver case. The rosary, blessed by the Pope, had been given to her by the Monsignor when she donated money for the new sacristy doors. A 2-inch thickness of oak, they bore her name engraved on a small brass plate that even years from now would continue to bear pure and fleshless testimony, as no child could, to her sanctity. Suddenly a horn sounded outside. Sam rushed to the window and looked out, still afraid that they'd come to take him back to the hospital. She smiled.
His money was gone, the last of it in the money order to Dr. Litchfield, who would never see her brother again. Sam could have saved himself the trouble of running away. She had planned on telling Litchfield at the end of that same week to release her brother because his money had run out. She owed Sam nothing, not a penny. God would be good to her. She had kept her mother alive well beyond her time, and for the past 10 years she had kept her brother off the streets. Hadn't the Monsignor himself pronounced her a living saint, declaring her path to heavenly reward well paved? She got up and went outside, eager to pluck weeds from her vegetables. The garden now took up most of the yard. Every spring she dug up another foot or two for an additional row of carrots or beets. Because it was too much food for just the three of them, she sent most of it to the rectory. She stooped between the cabbage heads and for a moment felt dizzy. Bees blazed across her vision. The velvety beans trembled with heaviness. Rini lied. He had no child, no son of his own. It was all this attention from the newspaper. Late last night she'd heard him whispering into the phone, insisting, "It couldn't be too late." Then he'd slumped over the kitchen table, staring at his own blurry baby picture. The tomatoes were dazzling, but ripening too soon. Already some had split their skin, engorged with her care and the relentless sun. The annual panic seized her. She was never ready for the tomatoes that were almost obscene in their abundance. She was never quite sure what to do with them all. She stood up and straightened her shoulders. She felt old. Her flesh shrank on her bones, while her breasts hardened to stone, she thought, as she labored up through the trapped heat of the porch stairs to the kitchen. Inside, Josiah sluiced the wet rag mop over the dull linoleum. At first, Helen thought the ammonia fumes had reddened Josiah's eyes until she heard the phlegmy sob. She pushed open the door and started past the crib where her mother dozed, propped against pillows, chin on her chest. Her mother's eyes opened wide.
"Please wash the rags,"
she begged in a tremulous voice, thin as a net snagged on some vivid moment in dreams or memory.
"Don't throw them out. Please wash them."
"Yes, Mother."
"Please. Oh, please, please, please."
"We're washing them," she snapped,
pushing open the door. She bore down on her brother, still hunched over his papers.
"What did you say to Josiah?" she demanded. "She's in there crying."
"Nothing."
He flicked his hand as if at some insect.
"I turned off her radio so I can hear the phone. I'm expecting a call."
"You'd best keep one thing in mind, Sam. The day she leaves here, you leave too."
She banged her fist on the table. He stretched back with a lazy smile.
"Actually, I'm thinking of firing her pretty soon anyway."
He picked up his papers. Her eyes narrowed. It sickened her to see him so amused and relaxed after his 7-week sojourn. The picture of health. Better, she hated to admit, than he'd looked in years. And why not? His every whim having been catered to, with an entire staff wringing their hands over his selfish miseries, while she was the one up night after night with their mother, changing diapers and kneading baby oil into her tissue-thin flesh that had never suffered bed sores or chafing. She stood there, trembling. Who did he think he was, sitting at her dining room table? Yes, hers, in spite of any documents. Hers for the price, the duty paid in dark hours, long silent days, months, in years, a lifetime, her life. Dismissing her with such smug confidence when one call to the police could send him back there. She told him this. He shrugged and said she was standing in his light. His light! Who were these people? Josiah, Rini, her brother, all fending her off, reaching past her. She refused to move, but he would not look up. In the other room, her mother's voice skittered with girlish nonsense, her sunless white hand groping through the bars for painted eggs and grosgrain ribbons for her hair. It was with greater love and tenderness ever yielded anyone that she'd bathed and fed and changed the towel-sized diapers of that withered child. And when the girl's voice sank into the dark folds of her mother's churlish demands, she'd stalk out of the room, refusing to answer or come until the child's soft cries returned to fill the barren space behind the bars and her loneliness. It was the child she more easily loved, the child lost in time, not the senile woman, for that was mere duty to a memory, to a mother who called her by her brother's name, and even now, after everything, after all his failure and cruelty, still wept for him. She stared at the back of her brother's head, her eyes dim with tears.
They were turning on her. She had held this house and the apartments and this mockery of a family together by the sheer force of her will. She had kept a roof over their heads. She had kept her mother alive, not only because with her death everything would be lost to Sam's children, but because they were all she had, these cold, ungrateful people. Demanding, devouring her strength, they had scraped and sucked her dry. Her hand trembled when lifting so much as a cup from its saucer. Things fell from her grasp. She felt breathless now as she hurried to the back of the house. Her mother clapped her bony blue hands as she passed by the crib. She needed to tell Josiah something, something about Carson, a vile tale heard years ago. Josiah stared uncomprehendingly at her.
"No, no,"
she finally said thickly, her hand at her breast.
"That ain't true, Miss LaChance. Grundy never fornicated a goat. He never kept goats. Just pigs, Miss LaChance."
"It was a pig, then," she insisted, heart racing. "I remember now, it was a pig." Josiah blinked, thought a minute.
"He wouldn't do that. Probably something to do with his first wife. Grandine says she was messier than any pig he ever kept."
She tried to laugh, but tears spilled down her ruddy cheeks.
"I can't believe you just said that to me, Miss LaChance. All this time I've been staying on because of you, because I thought we were like sisters almost."
She had been untying her apron. She put it on the counter, and then she left. 5:40, almost dinner time. Reney glanced at his watch as he climbed the steps to the Fermoyle house. After all these years, it was still known as the Fermoyle house, not the LaChance house. He had always been Helen Fermoyle's husband, Reney, a wart on the back of her hand, a minor affliction. Even here at the kitchen table, his place was one of deference in the chair on Helen's left. Sam nodded when he sat down. None of them spoke as they ate. As usual, the food was pasty, murky. Reney had little appetite. She would not look at him. She hated him for his foul secret expelled like gas in her bedroom. He stirred his watery summer squash into his mashed potatoes and was ashamed. With the heat wave letting up, sales were slow again, and no one gave a damn what Reney LaChance thought about anything. There was a shopping center coming to town. At the chamber meeting, he'd tried to warn his fellow merchants that people wouldn't come downtown anymore, but their biggest concern had been Joey's popcorn stands being an eyesore in the park. Helen picked at her dinner. She got up and scraped her plate into the garbage. She filled the sink with water. Sam, seeing her wait for his half-eaten plate, sat back and lit a cigarette, daring her to take away his plate before he was finished. Reney ate quickly, stuffing his mouth and chewing so loudly that Helen glanced disgustedly at him. He swallowed in a gulp and then began to choke. Sam whacked him on the back and Helen removed his plate. Reney stared into his coffee, wondering how he had endured this stifling family all these years. Helen squished her dish rag in the soapy sink water. She had sapped him of youth. He had been a sensitive young man, though few had ever guessed it. His short, thick fingers had betrayed him. His stocky torso had betrayed him. His runty legs had betrayed him. He had been a tender young man trapped in this coarse body when he first met Helen. His eyes searched the shelf of cups above her head. They were so precariously stacked, one tilted into the other, that for a moment he was sure they would fall. Perhaps that had been it. He could bear no calamity, yet calamity had pursued him from birth, and with blind singleness of purpose he'd tried to outdistance it, and when confronted he'd masked it, renamed it with lies. He remembered when he first saw Helen alone on the bus at night. Hours earlier he'd pushed past his father as he waved the accusing letter in his face, bellowing that he'd gotten a girl in trouble and now he'd pay. Riding alone, without money or destination, he'd finally introduced himself to the quiet woman, who went on nibbling her dry biscuit and would not look at him. Everything about the courtship seemed to surprise them both. When they were married, he had been so proud of her tapered fingers, her long, lovely neck, and careful manners. She proved what his thick fingers and clumsy tongue could not, that he was somebody. Sometimes he thought that was the reason he had stayed with her all these years, that in spite of her brother, she was still respected in town, which gave him status. But it was more than that, more and therefore less, diminishing him. It was because he feared calamity too much to leave her.
and so he had endured her sterility and her disdain with the secret comfort that somewhere there existed a child who would be grown now, with thick fingers and little brown eyes, his child, living among strangers and waiting to be found. It had happened in New York City when he was selling can openers door to door. Afterward, the woman had written in care of his company, which forwarded the crudely printed letter to his father. She was pregnant, desperate, alone, she said. Would he please do something, send her money for the hospital? Even then he more clearly remembered demonstrating the nickel-plated can opener with all its gadgets, the bottle cap opener, the knife sharpener, the two screwdriver heads, the dazzling corkscrew. Then he remembered her face or any conversation they might have had. She had been a large woman, her heavy bones lunging against him, her breath smothering him with sour intensity. It had been a dark room. They had been drinking. It had happened quickly, passionately, though he had come to think of it as violently, in a damp, creaking bed. Beatrice was all he remembered of her name. He looked up now as Helen berated Sam for stubbing out his cigarette in the bowl of mashed potatoes. She'd planned on reheating them for tomorrow night's dinner. Sam laughed and said that's exactly why he'd done it. They bickered like children, while from the other side of the door, Bridget's voice rose in the agitated chatter their arguments always aroused. Helen charged out of the kitchen.
God, Renie, Sam sighed as he put his plate in the sink. You've really got to do something about your wife's disposition.
Sam went out on the back steps to smoke another cigarette. Renie closed his eyes. The golden toasty salesman could never be the son of Renie LaChance and nameless, faceless Beatrice, who drank too much and welcomed strangers to her bed. No, that son surely hid his sausage fingers in his pockets when he met refined, delicate people. But what if the son had sprung from a fine, delicate gene? It was possible. Genes, eggs, sperm, something in that dark thrust, that zigzagging randomness, endowing him with such a child. He wondered if the son was married, had children of his own, lived not far from here. He smiled, imagining himself walking into that neat little house and filling it with every manner of appliance, all new, all free, with lifetime guarantees. The salesman had said he was adopted. Then how would he know that Renie was his father? Then again, maybe he didn't want to tip his hand too soon. But what if he hated his father, hated the coward who had sired a bastard and left him to cry alone, his only solace, Beatrice, on her musty bed in that lightless room? Perhaps the son had spent all these years plotting his revenge. Renie's hand trembled on the tabletop. It was 11 o'clock, and Joey Selden was still in his popcorn stand. He paused in his cleaning and cocked his head. He thought he'd heard branches snapping, where the forsythia grew, but the only sound now was crickets. With a sigh, he hitched up his sagging pants, which were weighted down by all the coins in his pockets. Tonight's crowd had been the biggest so far this summer. He bent over the cooler and fished out the last two sodas from the elbow-deep water. All the ice had melted. He felt down the side of the cooler and unscrewed the metal plug, then smiled as he wiped his arms dry. In spite of the ruckus at the end of the concert, it had been a grand night, just like the old days.
"Come on, Joey, close up. As it is, there's going to be hell to pay,"
Sonny had snapped last time he passed by. None of the commotion had been Joey's fault, but the chief's patience had obviously worn as thin as everyone else's. In recent years, whenever Joey had offered to retire rather than submit everyone to the bitter rigors of the annual license renewal, the judge wouldn't hear of it. Joey wasn't just the judge's old friend, he was also his last cause. In his final quavery oration before the alderman, the judge had declared Joey's popcorn stand as much a landmark as the bronze statue of Ethan Allen, both symbols of the community's goodness and strength. Joey hadn't been surprised at the buzz that ran through the members. There were still people who thought he'd been up at Ark Towler's still that night collecting hush money, when in truth his only crime had been love. He sank wearily onto his stool. Lately, he thought of her more and more, Winnie Towler, so young then with her tongue in his mouth. Sweet Winnie. She thought he'd planned the explosion to get rid of Ark so he could have her all to himself. But by God's all-witnessing eye, it had been Ark who turned the flame a notch higher, then lurched at him with a drunken vengeance that for an instant had seemed just another crude and blundering misstep in a friendship that went way far back before Winnie, sweaty and jumping from his arms, from the bed, at the first creak of her husband's loaded-down truck chugging up the road. Her long, high-boned face was the last image, the last vision he remembered having, even though he'd gone straight down to the still at the back of the barn when she jumped from the bed, so Ark would think it was him he'd come to see, and not her. Sweet Winnie, with her heat-frazzled hair caught in his mouth, and her eyes on his through the moonlight, frightened to hear Ark back.
"He tricked me," she hissed. "I don't know why he's doing this."
"Shh, shh, shh. I'll go down to the barn and head him off."
"I do what he says, but he don't even know what he wants anymore."
"Probably just forgot something."
"He'll beat me,"
she said, covering her ears as if she were hearing his heavy boots on the stairs.
"That's all he wants. That's all he really wants."
She was young, and Ark was his age. So once he started with her, love convinced him all she was to her husband was a drawing card, his bait. Pretty young thing, 3 babies in 3 years, not a sag or flab anywhere. The only blemishes the violet, menacing blooms of Ark's legendary temper on her soft, sweet flesh. But when he was thinking straight, he knew Ark Towler didn't need any other attraction than his whiskey, the best in that part of the state. Times were mean, and fortuitously, Ark's best friend had been Chief Joey Selden. Or was he, Ark had demanded that night, as he turned so suddenly from the bright jet at the end of the copper coil that he hadn't seen Ark's club until it cracked against his chest, knocking the wind out of him. It wasn't his whiskey, was it? Ark panted, whizzing the club past his head. It wasn't his booze and his friendship that kept the chief from shutting him down, because all that time Selden had been fucking his wife, leaving his smell in her to mock him when he crawled into his own bed, dog-tired night after night, until he couldn't take it any more, no more. No, sir. He was going out of his mind because it was way past duty now, that was clear, more than a chore. So he'd circled back because, Jesus, Jesus Christ, it was just too steep a price to pay any more. The two men had wrestled and grappled, staggering in one's drunken, the other's guilty embrace as they toppled stools and barrels and crates of empty bottles stacked for the new batch. Suddenly there was a poof, a flare of light, then flash after flash after flash as the spilled alcohol erupted in fiery hissing puddles across the wide planked floor, and Joey dove for the door, heat-borne through the orange blast and the concussive roar. She knelt over him, shrieking that he'd killed Ark, hadn't he? God, she never meant that, never meant any harm to come to the father of her 3 baby girls. So that was that, and no one ever knew the truth. Maybe not even her, sweet Winnie, who went a little crazy afterward, or maybe always was. And he'd been as blind then as now, only then it had been love, the last he would ever know of it. Besides, to be fair, what young widow wouldn't be frantic, having lost not only the support of her husband, as well as any hope of it with a blind lover, but also all of Ark's money, burned under a floorboard where he'd hidden it from the thieving revenue agents, and the pretty young wife he'd known from the start he couldn't trust, and so had put her to the test. Sweet, sweet Winnie's face, still luminous as a shimmering moon in this lifetime of nights. So after all he'd been through, all he'd lost, tonight's trouble was nothing. He laughed. Damn boys. They'd done it again, right when Jardine Green started playing Goodnight Irene on his violin. Once again, they'd managed to slip his radio out from between the broken boards and set it up on his roof where he couldn't get at it. Right before they took off, they turned the volume up full blast on the platters singing The Great Pretender. After the concert, Green banged his fist on the counter and told him to start counting the days. His time was up. The free ride was over. On Sonny's last trip by, he'd begged Joey not to give Green and his cohorts any more ammunition. He'd assured Sonny he'd be closing soon. Sonny said he'd wait and give him a ride home, but then the cruiser radio sputtered with the report of an accident up on the access road, car on its roof, teenagers inside. The cruiser door slammed and Sonny raced off, siren screaming. After Joey wiped down the inside of the cooler, he propped up the lid with a stick to air it out. He checked the outlets one last time to make sure all his plugs were disconnected. Smiling, he wound the cord around the radio and put it under the counter. Poor Green, what a fool. Now there was a man who had not lived enough. Joey sat on his stool and began to count his money before he put it into the cigar box. He continued to take his time.
This was all he needed anymore. The clear night air, the soft rustle of the leaves, the black sky he imagined pierced with stars. Dressed in black, Robert Haddad peered out from the tangled forsythia. Sweat stung his eyes as he watched Joey Selden. His hand shook. It was the waiting. At 11:10, the telephone jangled through the dark rectory. Sound asleep for the last hour, Monsignor Burke put the pillow over his head and waited for someone to answer it. When the ringing finally stopped, he rolled onto his side and fell asleep. Again the phone began to ring, this time louder, louder, louder. Monsignor picked up the phone, his gruff answer causing Sister Mary Patrick, the nursing home supervisor, to stammer in apology, especially since poor Mrs. Ahern had been through this twice before. But now there could be no doubt. The old woman was drifting in and out of consciousness. With her kidneys failing, this was surely the end.
"Finally, poor dear,"
the nun whispered, as if the call were being made from the old woman's bedside.
"I tried to wait with the late hour and all, but she's going fast, Monsignor, and besides, it's Father Gannon she's asking for."
He was relieved, if not a little hurt. A silly woman, given to nervous giggling in the confessional, Mrs. Ahern had been his parishioner for years.
"Father Gannon's been with her the last two times,"
the nun explained.
"He's such a kind young man, holding her hand and all, but surely I don't think that'll be enough this time."
He assured her Father Gannon would be right up.
"Sorry to wake you,"
Sister said.
"I know what you've been through lately, Monsignor, with the poor Hines family."
"They've had more than their share lately," he sighed.
Most of his free time these past few weeks had been spent at the lake with his cousin Nora and her husband Cleve, though it seemed Cleve was having to be in town most nights these last few weeks. Nora said it was just all too painful for him, although the boy was in remission now.
"The poor thing, and him being their only son. Bernard, isn't it?"
"Yes, Bernard Thomas, actually."
"Sure, and that's right after you, Monsignor. I'd forgotten. Tell me now, is it that?"
"Yes, Sister, it is."
"Cancer. Leukemia, actually." Father Gannon's bed was empty, and the Monsignor was not surprised. Out all hours of the night, the young man could barely get up on time for morning mass. When he complained, the bishop suggested he should be grateful the young priest had found such a suitable outlet for his idealistic energies as the Kennedy campaign.
"Sometimes," the bishop reminded him, "to keep this new breed happy, we have to let them roam just a bit farther afield than we might like."
And besides, the bishop added, he and the senator's dad went way back. He padded barefoot down the hallway, relieved when he came to the rim of light under the bathroom door. He tapped once, then turned the knob, bewildered to see Father Gannon at the sink, bare-chested in his clerical pants, a razor poised at his lathered cheek.
"But I can't," Father Gannon said upon hearing that Mrs. Ahern needed the last rites. "I've got a meeting."
His stricken expression troubled the Monsignor.
"You have a sacrament to administer, Father Gannon, and that is far, far more important than any meeting."
He looked at him hard, adding,
"With anyone."
"No." "No," he thought, seeing Father Gannon wince. It couldn't be. Not right under his nose. No, he was a better pastor than that. In matters of celibacy, the bishop held his older clergy responsible for guiding the young men.
"But I'm expected, and I can't call now,"
he swallowed with widening eyes.
"Could you do it for me, please, Tom? Please."
His insolence was shocking.
"She asked specifically for you, Father, not me," he said.
Head bowed, the young priest shuffled miserably.
"You could tell her I'm away. This sounds terrible, I know, but, you see, this has happened before, and then nothing ever comes of it."
Something hardened in the Monsignor's throat. It hurt to speak.
"I think you have a choice to make here, Father Gannon. I pray your decision is the right one."
He returned to his room, where he sat in the dark on the edge of his rumpled bed, feet fast on the prickly wool carpet, eyes hard on the shaded window, until he finally heard the garage door rumble open, and then the tires of his car turning over the pavement. There had been distant sirens wailing, and now their growing urgency seemed to justify his firmness with the troubled young priest. All this talk of nerves and needs and complexes was ridiculous. Father Gannon had been coddled, plain and simple.
What he needed now was discipline before he ended up another of the insipid dilettantes who only dabbled in God's work when the mood hit them. The seminaries were sending them out in droves lately. Me, 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 and the needs of the church be damned. Gone were the days when a young priest cared enough about advancement to do all he could to lighten his superior's load. It was time now for a dose of reality, time to teach Father Gannon responsibility to his vocation and his parishioners. He would call his cousin Nora in the morning. If her invitation to the lake was still open, he'd accept, and leave Father Gannon completely in charge here. She didn't know what to do. She couldn't stand out here by the road any longer. Joe had never been this late before. All the lights in the lot were out. Mr. Coughlin had already left, and the office was locked, so she couldn't even call home for a ride. And she certainly couldn't call the rectory and ask for Joe. Two of the girls had offered her a ride, and so had Blue Mooney, with Carper grinning and echoing everything his cousin said, until Blue had snapped at him to shut up. God, it was like living in a freak show, she thought, as she started to walk down Main Street. It was worse at home, with Duval in and out all the time, proclaiming that the soap was coming. Yes, the soap was definitely on its way. He'd just heard the soap was coming. The warehouse was working round the clock to fill all the orders, and now her mother was saying it, too. When the soap comes, what, you need school activity fees in 2 weeks? Well, maybe the soap will be here then. Whatever the problem, she'd take care of it after the soap came. Her father had been home for 2 weeks now and hadn't called them once. Benji was a nervous wreck, and the open animosity between Norm and Omar was almost frightening. And on top of it all, last night, as she was putting her clothes back on in the Monsignor's car, Joe had said that making love to her was all he ever thought or cared about now, even during Mass. Twice during the consecration that morning, he'd lost his place and had to start over. When he talked like that, she never knew what to say. Upset by her silence, he'd beg her to tell him what was wrong, what was bothering her. But how could she explain this violent commingling of guilt and longing that left her feeling bruised and sore without it sounding like a confession, an admission of the worst sin, desire, but not love? What if Lester was right? What if she was so tainted by base needs that there would never be love, only corruption? When pressed, she would tell Joe that it was the same with her, that she loved him, too, thought of him every bit as much all day long. And as the evening wore on, the desire would feel like another organ, as hot and throbbing as if it were about to burst. She was afraid of what was happening, but she couldn't tell him the truth, couldn't admit when he held her close, whispering that he couldn't bear the thought of her leaving, that she was counting the days until school started. It was the only way it could possibly end without the shame and damnation destroying them both. She was walking past the municipal swimming pool now when a car slowed behind her. Joe. She walked a little faster, smiling.
Hey, hop in,
Blue Mooney called as he drove alongside.
I'll give you a ride home.
She didn't need a ride. In fact, she was enjoying the walk.
But it's late,
he protested, cruising so close she could feel the car's heat on her legs.
Come on,
he coaxed.
Please. You never been in my car. I'd really like you to see it. Look,
he said with a sweep of his arm.
I got all velvet on the dash, and same with the seats.
He looked up, his pale eyes shining under the street lamp.
I'll bring you straight home, if that's what you're thinking, honest to God.
No, she stopped and shook her head. I really, really want to walk. At that, he turned off the lights and parked the car. He got out and came toward her.
Then I'll walk with you,
he announced, tugging his jeans down over his hips and rolling and flexing his shoulders. Stupid creep, she thought, hugging her arms and growing more annoyed as she hurried along to the clop of his thick-heeled boots through the midnight quiet. God, you're going to wake up the whole town, she snapped, irritated then to see him scurry onto the grass, where he kept stumbling in the ruts. He'd been telling her about his job, and now he was advising her to avoid retreads.
Granted, they're half the price, but when they blow, I mean, you have no idea what that's like, being so out of control. I mean, they lay down rubber in this whole long strip.
He held out his arms to show her.
A person could get killed,
he said, his earnestness a poultice to her venom. Then how come you sell them? God, did he really think that driving tires back and forth to Burlington was such a big deal?
Well, I mean, it's my job,
he stammered.
You know, besides, I don't sell them, I just haul them.
Doesn't that bother you?
No. Why should it?
Well, what if one of the tires you've hauled blows out and somebody gets really hurt or something? I mean, wouldn't you feel responsible?
No.
He looked at her.
Not at all. I mean, why should I, you know?
Well, I would, she said, stepping off the curb to cross the street. They were near the park. Joey's popcorn stand was empty. The dark grass was dotted with cans and papers. Norm would be busy tomorrow with his pick.
That's because you've been hanging around that priest too much, Mooney said,
and for a moment she stopped breathing. They came past the diner, the boarding house.
What's he, a friend or something?
Yeah, she said with a weak shrug.
Well, just make sure he doesn't pile all that church stuff on you about sin and guilt. I mean, the way I figure it is, I'm just going to do the best I can, and if it don't work out, hey, I'm not going to go around feeling guilty all the time.
He laughed self-consciously when she didn't say anything.
Jeez, listen to me with all the good advice tonight. Hey!
He stopped and put his hand on her arm.
Listen.
He cocked his head.
Can you hear that?
All she heard were crickets and the stale rasp of his smoky breath by her face. He kept urging her to listen, listen close. What is it? She asked, pretending to hear it as she eased from his grip.
Must be an owl,
he whispered, his eyes scanning the black treetops over the park.
There. Hoo, hoo,
he called softly, cupping his hands to his mouth.
Hoo, hoo.
Now she did hear it, faint as an echo. Mooney hurried beside her. He said it sounded like a great horned owl.
We used to go down the pond at night and shine flashlights on them. It was weird the way they'd freeze for a minute. They'd stare back like they were ticked off, and then they'd raise these big wings, and the weird thing was, they'd take off without a sound. That always got me, the way they seemed like part of the night, and then the light catches them, and they're, you know, what's the word I want? Exposed, I guess, and then they're gone, right back into the dark. That's what they know, you see, that's where they belong.
Goosebumps rose on her arms, and then the back of her neck, as if a winter door had suddenly blasted open. I don't know anything, she thought, feeling big and clumsy beside him, though she was half his size. He paused, listening, then cupped his mouth and hooted softly again. I can't believe you heard that. It was so faint. She hadn't heard anything that time, but she wanted to say something nice. He smiled.
It's like, you know how some people have great night vision? Well, I'm that way with sounds.
Must be the same thing that animals have, a real keen sense of hearing.
I don't know. I hear things in this weird way. I don't know how to put it, but sometimes I hear things before they're even sounds. That's kind of weird, huh?
He seemed embarrassed. Well, it's probably like with dogs, she said. They hear things we can't hear. It's this whole other range they've got and we don't. It's probably something like that.
Yeah, well, maybe,
he said, growing quiet as they neared her corner. When they turned, he spoke suddenly, calling her by name for the first time.
Alice?
He looked surprised.
You're not still going out with Lester Stoner, are you?
He asked in a torrent of words and nervous gestures.
I mean, I never see him around or anything, and that's why I was wondering.
Sensing what he had in mind, she said that she and Lester had broken up, and that she wasn't interested in dating because there was so little time left before she started school. He smiled.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I can see that. I mean, not having, you know, a steady boyfriend or anything. But how about just going out for a drive, maybe, or even a movie with somebody?
He looked at her.
With me, I mean.
Oh, God. I can't, she said. I'm sorry. His mouth twitched as he struggled to hold the smile.
Hey, don't be sorry. Like I said, you've been hanging around that priest too much.
There's my house. You don't have to go all the way down there. She assured him she'd be fine. He said he'd gone this far, and he just wanted to make sure she got the rest of the way home safely. There was nothing to worry about, she said, then hurried on ahead. When she was almost at the house, the sound of sirens tore up Main Street. She looked back as she turned into the driveway, and sure enough, he was still watching her. He waved. Groaning, she waved back. She opened the door, then looked again before stepping inside. He was still there, watching. In the park, Sonny Stoner squatted by Joey's side, holding his hand until the ambulance came. His patrolman's flashlights passed slowly over the litter-covered grass for clues. Whatever the weapon,
It had split open the back of Joey's head, but hadn't killed him. His cigar box with the night's receipts was missing. He had closed the stand and was coming along the path when he heard footsteps behind him. He had felt a tug as someone tried to yank the cigar box out from under his arm. He had held on to it, wrestling with his assailant, who kept begging him not to.
"Don't," the man had pleaded. "Please don't. I beg you, please."
And then the blow had been struck, and Joey lay at the edge of the rhododendrons.
"For so long," he told Sonny, his flat eyes rolling with pain.
He had lain through green heat and wind and brilliant falling leaves and frost and drifting snow and chilly mud, then heat again, while to all his cries for help had come the answering hoot of an owl with fiery, glowing eyes.
"I saw it, Sonny. Right there in the bush, watching me."
He groped for Sonny's hand and held it against his face.
"I never took money from Towler. Never."
Tears ran from the corners of his eyes down his blood-smeared temples.
"I know that, Joey. I've always known that," he whispered, leaning close. "You're a good man, Joey, a good, honest man."
He squeezed Joey's hand.
"You never took a damn thing that wasn't yours." "No, listen. Listen," he said, his voice breaking. "It was her I took. His wife, Winnie."
"Shh."
"Just relax, Joey. Don't say any more now. Just breathe deep in and out. I hear them coming." "He was my friend. He knew money wouldn't work. I'd go up and I'd say, 'Ark, Ark, I gotta do something. People are talking. You're forcing my hand, Ark.' So what he did was, he let me have her. I'd come, he'd leave. I thought she loved me, but you see, I was just one more of her chores. Only I was the one she hated doing most of all. And I was so stupid," he said, both laughing and crying, "that I never knew it. Took me years, all these years. Ain't that something, huh?"
he asked with wonder.
"Don't, Joey. That's all." "No. No, I know. But you see, all these years, I've been sending her money. The judge took care of it. Sonny, if I die, send her what I got, please." "Sure, Joey, sure."
He patted the old man's hand as he looked past the bandstand right at the spot where she'd stood all those years before, hugging her children to her skirt with that peculiar look of bitter triumph on her angular face. The arc of a patrolman's flashlight guided the ambulance down the path. The attendants jumped out and dropped to their knees beside Joey. So that's why, Sonny thought, as they prepared him for the stretcher, all these years that's why he endured the town council's annual humbling. For her. For a woman he kept hoping might still love him.
"Jesus Christ,"
the ambulance driver called when the back door closed.
"What a night."
Sonny watched the ambulance speed up Main Street, its lights flashing and sirens screaming. The accident up on the mountain earlier tonight had put two kids in the hospital, Donna Kreller and Weeb Miller. There had been beer in the car. Young Miller wouldn't say where he had gotten it, but Sonny Stoner knew it had to be from Hildy Carper. Tomorrow, between Al Kreller and Jardin Green and God knew who else, all hell would break loose. And where had their illustrious chief been through it all? Getting laid, that's where, in Eunice's perfumed satin sheets, while his wife shriveled to bones and the circles under his depressed son's eyes darkened.
"Chief!"
Officer Harrison called. His two patrolmen were leading Blue Mooney toward him.
"Look what we got here. Says he just happens to be passing by,"
Bernie Clapman scoffed.
"Yeah, out for a little midnight stroll,"
Vince Nieder sneered.
"Go fuck yourself," Mooney growled, jerking free of their grasp,
feeling safer now, Sonny knew, in his presence.
"Chief, I..."
Mooney was starting to protest, just as Sonny grabbed his shirt and yanked him close.
"I'm gonna ask you one time and one time only. Did you touch Joey Selden tonight?"
"No, of course not. Jesus, I already told them. I never even saw him."
They drove Mooney back to his car. Harrison was going through the trunk, which was filled with cigarette cartons and bags of clothes. He emptied the bags onto the ground.
"Look at this,"
Harrison called, coming around the side of the car, carrying a cowboy hat.
"Here,"
he said, holding it out.
"Put it on."
"What for?"
Mooney asked.
"'Cause I said so,"
Harrison said, jamming the hat on Mooney's head, pulling it down over his ears.
"Leave it on,"
Harrison barked as Mooney reached to take it off.
"So, tell us again now,"
said Harrison as Nieder took his place, rifling through the mess in the trunk.
You're driving along, and all of a sudden, for no reason, you stop. You leave the car here, 2 blocks from the park. It's a nice night, right? So what the hell? You figure you'll take a little stroll through the park. And what do you see but old Joey gimping along with a box of dough under his arm, and you're broke, right? So you figure, what the hell? This one's easy.
Chief,
Mooney pleaded. This time, Sonny wouldn't interfere. This time, he'd let them do their job. Besides, he was almost enjoying the punk's humiliation with the hat flapping his ears forward.
I don't need to go mugging a blind man. I got a job, a good job. I'm working for J.C. Coulter.
A job? Harrison said. I thought you were on leave. He's on leave, all right. Permanent leave, Vince Nieder said, swaggering around the side of the car.
He handed Sonny the document stamped with the Marine Corps seal that attested to the dishonorable discharge of Travis T. Mooney. Sonny squinted over the rim of his glasses. His officers, Mooney, the car, all glowed in the light from the street lamp. He had tried to save men whose redemption was easier than his own, and now this was the end of the foul trail. He was no better than any of them, only worse in his hypocrisy. Simpler, better men than he was saw the truth in life. Because Joey had looked the other way, the gods had demanded his sight. There was always a price to pay. As talisman, he'd offered Mooney and Joey, even, he realized now with disgust, his wife's suffering to prove his goodness. He stepped closer, and his shadow obscured Mooney's face. His voice was cold and steady.
I should have let them put you away when I had the chance. Yeah? And how come you didn't?
Mooney leered at him. He drew back his hand.
You're trash, Mooney,
he said, slapping him again and again.
Just like your brother. Nothing but trash.
Mooney lunged for him, but Harrison and Nieder were on each arm now, pinning him in place. When it was over, Sonny walked back to his cruiser, holding his heaving stomach. It was the first time he had ever beaten a man. The oldest cells were in the basement under the police station in Town Hall. Bootsteps scraped along the dark granite passageway. His head ached with the approaching echo. One eye was still swollen, his cheek bruised a reddish purple. He lay curled on the damp cot, pretending to sleep. Nieder had been the last one down. It was Sunday, and for 2 days they'd taken turns at this, but his story hadn't changed. He'd given his cousin a ride home from work, then had driven back to town, parked his car, and gone for a walk, alone. He wouldn't involve her. He wouldn't even think of her while he was here. The cell door creaked open.
Wake up,
Stoner ordered with a jab at his back. He lowered his feet to the floor, then sat up and pressed his temples.
I can't keep you any more, Mooney, but just so you'll know.
Stoner stood so close he had to lean back to see him.
We're going to be watching you,
Stoner smiled.
And one of these days you're finally going to get what you've been looking for.
You think so?
He said. Only now that he was on his feet, allowing himself thoughts of her, and these dizzied him more than the pain in his skull. Sonny's eyes moved wearily over him.
You make me sick. You haven't even asked one time how poor old Joey's doing.
Oh, yeah?
He held onto the bars and looked back.
How's he doing? Better than me, I hope.
He had to take deep breaths to keep from passing out. Sonny just shook his head and stalked out into the corridor. It was early Sunday morning. The kitchen smelled of bleach as the washing machine gurgled and vibrated from cycle to cycle. The table was covered with red-inked bills and the dreaded budget book, each fold-out pocket labeled mortgage, gas, electricity, food, clothes, entertainment, medical. Every week, $2 went into the electricity slot, 10 into food, 2 into gas, 25 into mortgage. Clothes, entertainment, and medical were always empty. Any time they dared complain about not having something, Marie would unpleat the budget book to show how close to the bone they lived. Right now she was looking at Alice's bank book. Benji sat across the table from Alice. They were both in their pajamas. Norm was still in bed. There had been an argument late last night between Marie and Omar. It was the first time Benji had heard Omar angry at his mother. According to her calculations, Alice's earnings from the A plus X, even counting these next few weeks, would pay only part of her first semester's bill.
I told you, Alice said, her uncombed hair sticking out from her head.
She'd gotten in late again last night,
long after the argument, long after Norm told Benji if Omar said one more word to her, he was going down there and throw him out. She had gotten home long after Omar slammed the front door and drove off, long after their mother cried herself to sleep.
I could have made 10 times that much at the lake, but you wouldn't let me.
Norm, his mother called again toward the stairs. Get down here right now. He came into the kitchen, squinting and scratching his chest. She didn't want any argument, she said, pacing back and forth, but she was going to have to use some of his money for Alice's first semester bill.
That's okay, Norm said with a shrug. Long as I have enough for my car, he muttered,
and Benji was relieved his mother hadn't heard. Ever since Weeb's accident, Norm had been very quiet. In these last few days, he seemed older, certainly more considerate. Both of Weeb's legs were in casts. Donna Kreller had a mangled foot and a ruptured spleen, and the police had declared war on underage drinking. Alice shook her head with a long sigh, which his mother pounced on. What? Didn't Alice approve? Well, maybe if she hadn't waited until the last minute, she could have gotten a better-paying job in town. The nerve, sitting there sighing and giving one another looks, the three of them. Well, what else could she do? If they knew of a better way, please tell her. Please, because she was at the end of her rope. This was it, the end of the line.
It only goes just so many ways, and then that's it, she cried, grabbing the budget book and with a flick of her wrist, snapping it so that like a card trick the manila pockets cascaded open.
It's okay, Mom, Norm said. Whatever you have to do is fine. I can probably even get some overtime these next few weeks.
She bit her lip and took a sharp breath. She'd done her best, she said, but as always, it just wasn't good enough.
Mom, that's not true, Alice said. Besides, we can get a loan. Other people do.
No, she shook her head, and her eyes shimmered with tears.
It's not like you're asking for charity or anything, Alice said softly.
I can't. I've already got a loan. She laughed bitterly. And I can't even come up with the next payment, so they're sure as hell not going to give me another one.
A loan for what? Norm asked, but she didn't answer. Eyes closed, she kept shaking her head and swallowing hard. The car? He asked. Something in the house? What? He pointed. The roof? Mom, what is it?
Was it for Dad, Mom? Alice asked. She touched her mother's hand. It was, wasn't it? She said with a rueful sigh.
In this painful way, they were all still a family.
You tried to help him. And he just messed everything up again, didn't he?
Oh, God, no, she gasped, as if that would have been the ultimate folly. She explained that it had been an investment in Omar's new business, which she continued to have faith in, but her timing had been all wrong. Instead of being so impulsive, she should have recognized Omar's promise of such a quick return on her money for what it was, his unrestrainable enthusiasm and optimism. She had no doubt the soap was coming, and she knew she'd be making money as soon as she got out there and started selling such a surefire, wonderful product as Presto soap was. But in the meantime, there were all these regular bills, as well as Alice's first semester bill. Forget about back-to-school clothes. And now, on top of all that, there was the loan. And if she didn't come up with the money, they could lose the house. No one said anything.
What are we going to do? Alice said.
I don't know. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
I could postpone.
No, she cried, staring Alice down, as if she were just trying to find a way out of going to school.
What I'm going to do is call your father and tell him he has to do something, that we're desperate.
I'll say, Norm said. That's pretty desperate, all right.
Oh, and do you have a better idea?
Benji and Alice exchanged looks as once again their mother and brother geared up for battle, each drawing strength from the other's challenge.
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact.
His eyes didn't waver from hers.
Why don't you get your money back from Duval?
Because, she explained, it had already been invested in her franchise.
Yeah, and in his caddy and his mysterious trips and his...
Realizing she was crying, Norm jumped up.
I'll get your money, Mom. I swear I will.
No,
she said, ordering him back down. But he remained standing. She had faith in Duval, she said, faith in the company. No, the trouble had been her poor timing.
Benji had been folding an envelope smaller and smaller. That's not the trouble, Mom, Norm cried, leaning over her.
When are you going to face the facts? When are you going to see what Duval really is?
She didn't answer, and in the silence, Benji folded the tiny wad again, now bit the edges to make it hold.
I must have known in the back of my mind she'd arrange something, Sam was saying of his mother as Marie drove. But if I did, well, I never knew what it was, exactly. And you know the judge, he wouldn't give me the time of day without Helen's permission.
He chuckled, then looked at her with a bitter sigh.
But I swear to you, Marie, I never knew there was a trust. I mean, $10,000? Don't you think if I had, I would have made sure you and the kids got part of it?
No, she thought, he wouldn't have. If he had known, he probably would have drunk himself to death with it. But she didn't say this. She didn't dare make him mad. She wanted to appear both firm and sympathetic. He said he'd spent these past 2 weeks at home getting himself ready. For what? Came the old sour voice in her head. He'd spent a lifetime getting ready, getting geared up, trying to get back on track. God, she knew all the lines. He had gotten a haircut. His nails were trimmed. His old shoes shined, the cracks in the leather dark with polish. His faded shirt and shiny pants were pressed. The jacket he wore was a loud green and yellow plaid, the sleeves too short, the cut too wide. He'd probably taken it from Rini's closet without even asking. In the old days, he wouldn't have left the house in clothes like that. Now he obviously thought he looked quite natty. He was telling her how he'd made a list of